If you don't have a handout, if you raise your hand, someone will get one to you. Here's one here. The handout's about John the Baptist. There's an arrow in there that points to a little paragraph that's really the most important part of that handout as far as we're concerned today. But we'll discuss that in a few minutes. There you go. That's it. Today we're talking about the text. Teaching the text and the context. What's a context? The text with the text, isn't it? Is that what context means? What comes before and what comes after. So we're going to do a little bit of practice with that this morning. And then draw a fairly complicated lesson from it. So you'll need to kind of follow along with what we're talking about as we get into this, but it answers some interesting puzzles in the Gospels for us if we realize how the disciples of Jesus learned and remembered everything that he taught them. We've been starting our classes with a sort of a verse. Something Jesus said that might be useful as we teach somebody else. We haven't really talked about this much, but it's perfectly clear that one of the very strong points that convinces many people to pay attention is the fact that in the Hebrew Bible, there were many prophecies about the coming Messiah, and by fulfilling all of these prophecies, Jesus, of course, proved that he was the individual the prophets were talking about. So we're going to look at one of those verses where Jesus actually says this himself, and it's after he's been crucified and resurrected, and he's talking with his disciples. Let's stand and recite this verse together. Luke 24 and 44. Jesus said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." Thank you. Please be seated. Everything that is written about me. Some people have tried to do those counts of prophecies in the Old Testament. They come up with over 300. Burton Kaufman says 333. I don't know. That's an easy number to remember. Some you might wonder about, but most of them are pretty clear, and they're answered in the life of Jesus in a variety of ways as he lived out. You see, that's living, in his case, a very special instance of it, but that's living the text. And if you looked at the schedule today, we're talking about knowing the text, teaching the text, and living the text. And the text in this case is the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament. So to know the text, and we just to review briefly, when they were children, they memorized the text as much as they could. And the really skilled ones would remember and memorize all of what we call the Old Testament. The law of Moses, the writings, the prophets, the poetry, the history. They knew all of that. Have you ever tried to memorize a long passage? We don't do a lot of that, do we? There's sort of a joke that was repeated back in the days of radio. Anybody remember radio? And I'm sure I heard it on Fibber McGee and Molly. And again on, several of the programs of that sort, where a salesman knocks on the front door and they open the door, and he says something like, "Good afternoon, sir. I represent the All-American Vacuum Cleaner Company. And if you would buy an All-American vacuum cleaner, you would have the very best vacuum cleaner made in America." And then Fibber McGee would interrupt him and say something about, well, what does it cost? He'd say, good afternoon, sir. I represent the... He'd have to go back to the very beginning of his spiel every time to get to the point how much it costs was further down the line. Well, we have clues about memory work. And that works on short things. But if you tried to memorize everything Moses wrote, the Pentateuch, for example, you can't start back in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, every time to get something down in Exodus. You'd never get to it. So there have to be starting and stopping points along the way. And so the rabbi was constantly working with his disciples to get the context of the verses that they were interested in. Now, we've taken a technological leap in that sort of thing by having all of our chapters numbered, all of our verses numbered, and so we can go to John 3:16, and or we can go to Exodus 3:17, and we can look at these verses and look them up ourselves, even on a computer now. Just type in the numbers, and it pops up on the screen. So we use a technical memory device, don't we, to do that. But we don't memorize it, really. And they didn't have that. How are you going to find verses like this if you don't have that kind of anything to lean on to mark these verses so that you can recall them and everybody look at the same verse? So we'll see some examples of that. Here's one in Luke 20. Where Jesus is talking to the Sadducees. This follows, we'll ask the question in a minute about what does it follow and what does it precede. But Jesus in this verse, they've asked him a question, and then he's going to tell them about the resurrection. And so he cites something. He says, in the account of the bush, Moses showed that the dead rise, for he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but the God of the living, for to him all are alive. So that may be a familiar verse to you. I hope that it is. So he refers to a passage in the Hebrew Bible, the account of the bush. So you can guess that along the way they had marked little spots in the text in their minds. This is about something, this is about something else, this is about something else. So what is the account of the bush? What bush is he talking about? The burning bush. What burning bush? The one that he's talking about. Yeah. This is... So let's just review, just briefly, in the account of this citation. Now, we know where it is, and we'll record it in terms of a chapter. What chapter of what book is it? What book is it? Maybe I'm guessing too much here. This is the book of Exodus, and it's the third chapter. So what happened just before this verse that Jesus is citing? He says, God said this, and at that point, what came just before it? What about the bush? What? You've already talked about it. The bush is on fire, isn't it? That's what happens just before. Well, you go back a little bit further in that story, you find that Moses has taken his father's flock to where? The mountain of God. This, in this case, it's Sinai. They call it what? Horeb. That's right. And so he's up there with all these sheep, and he sees something very strange. What does he see? A bush? Yeah, it's on fire, but it's not really burning up. Now, I pointed out to you a number of times in the past in some classes that we've had, That's a very important Old Testament symbol. It represents what God wants to do with his relationship to Israel. Israel's the bush. God is the fire. He wants to dwell in the bush, but not destroy it. You see, that's a very difficult thing for God if the bush is evil, if the bush harbors sin, if Israel is sinful. God can't dwell in sin. So that's a really important landmark in the Old Testament. Now, what comes after this? Well, the verses that he talks about happen in this account. And then what comes next? What does God ask of Moses after that? Well, that comes just before this. But anyway, he wants them to do what? He wants Moses to do what? Okay, I'm going to send you down to Egypt and ask Pharaoh to let Israel go. So that's the part that comes next. Well, let's look at some other examples. That's what happened after. The death of David's infant son. These are all Old Testament. We'll look at a gospel one in a minute. Remember the death of David's infant son. That's the clue. Sort of like playing Jeopardy now. Okay, y'all like that. All right. Whose death preceded that event? All right. Uriah the Hittite died. Whose birth followed the death of David's infant son? Solomon. So if you know the context, then you see you don't have to know chapters and verses. You can string a lot of this together if you know the sequence of events, and you don't have to. Now, we don't have to memorize the verses and recite them, but the rabbi had his disciples not just tell him what happened. All right, now quote the scripture. And they could do it. They could do it, and it puts us to shame, I think, in terms of our recognition of the Old Testament scriptures, or the New Testament, for that matter. Let's put that a little more meat on these bones. What did Uriah's death have to do with the death of the infant son of David? Okay, the baby that was born to David and Bathsheba involved the death of Uriah, didn't it? In fact, who had him killed? David did. And as part of his consequences of this great sin that David committed, God told him, your son will die. The son born to Bathsheba will die. Well, what's that have to do with Solomon's birth later on? What? He's going to inherit the throne, but what does it have to do with the death of the infant son? Well, it says afterwards that David comforted Bathsheba in the death of her baby. And it actually shows, I think, to us in a very real way that God had forgiven them for what they did. Because the next baby that, and Bathsheba has another baby, and it's another son, and it's Solomon, and it says God loved Solomon, didn't he? And if you follow that story on along, he's the one who's going to inherit the throne. Well, let's look at another. Oh, that's right. There were consequences that still came. That's a good point to make, that although the guilt was taken away apparently, and in a rather strange twist, you might could argue that by the death of his son, the guilt of David and Bathsheba was to some degree, the guilt of it was mitigated. That's symbolic, really, like a lot of other things in the Old Testament about God giving his son. Let's look at an example from the Gospels. We're going to talk about this in a few minutes. The arrest and imprisonment of John the Baptist. What happened before that? Why is he in prison? Hmm? Yeah, he confronted Herod the way Ahab was confronted by Elijah. Yeah, and Ahab was married to Jezebel, and it turns out that Herod's wife is sort of a symbol of Jezebel too, isn't she, in many ways. And so, just like Jezebel tried to kill Elijah, we'll see that similar sort of thing happening here. So he said, it's not right for you to have your brother Philip's wife as your wife. What was her name? Herodias, right? Okay, and of course Herod didn't like to hear that, but who was really angry? Herodias was really angry about that confrontation. And so he put John the Baptist in jail. All right, that's what went before and what got him into trouble. And then what happened after? Who? She who? The daughter of Herodias at a birthday party for whom? For Herod. She did a dance, and Herod was so pleased with it all that he promised something. What? Anything she wants, up to half of the kingdom. Now, you've heard that story. You might have had that in Bible class as a child. Well, and so what did Salome ask for? Why? Mama asked for that. And so she went to Herod with that request, and then they beheaded John the Baptist and brought his head to the party. So that happened, and that was the end of John the Baptist. So we're going to look in a few minutes at a situation that involves that. So kind of remember that story. Now this happened near the end of his ministry. In Matthew 21, the blind and the lame, this is at the temple in Jerusalem, came to him, that is to Jesus, at the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple area, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were indignant. Can't you keep your kids in check? Why do you let your kids talk in church? Why do you let them shout in church? Why, you know, you kind of get an idea of what they're complaining about here. But do you hear what these children are saying? They asked him. And yes, replied Jesus, have you never read? That's kind of interesting. They had read it all. They had memorized it. And it's sort of a thrust and a twist when he says, have you never read? What? Well, this is Psalm 8 and 2, from the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise. And he left them and went out of the city to Bethany, where he spent the night. Over in Luke it says, at this point in the story, they went out and started plotting how to kill him. They wanted to kill Jesus. Why would they want to kill him for this verse? Well, if you know the context, you get another piece of the puzzle here. Because Psalm 8 and 2 says, from the lips of children and infants you've ordained praise because of your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. And of course, he didn't have to say that. They knew what came next. They knew the context, and it made them angry. He's calling them a foe and an avenger. They're the enemy, you see. And so that made them very angry. If you know the context, you'll detect some more things. When you have a verse of Scripture in the Gospels and it says this had something to do with a prophecy or it's a quotation from Jesus or one of the apostles, go look it up in the Old Testament. If you look at the context, you might get some new information. And we'll see a couple of remarkable cases of that in a few minutes. Now, we're going to talk about John the Baptist. We've already discussed his problem here. This news about Jesus, that is raising the dead at Nain, we better talk about that context for a moment. Who did he raise at Nain? Who was it? David over here, David Powers knows. Who else? There was a widow whose only son had died, and Jesus happened up, approached the city just as they led out a funeral procession, right? And what did he do? He turned the bunch around and sent them back into town, didn't he? He stopped the procession, put his hand on the funeral bier, which is, what would that do? That would be a no-no, wouldn't it? To touch the dead or anything having to do with the dead, would the Jews had a lot of rules about that sort of thing. But Jesus did it, and then what did he do? He raised the boy, or the young man, from the dead and gave him back to his mother. And, of course, that news would spread rapidly, wouldn't it? Throughout Judea and the surrounding country, John's disciples told him about all these things. Now, the handout that I gave you says what almost all of the commentaries say about John the Baptist. That at this point, his faith wavered, and he wasn't really sure if Jesus was the Messiah or not. If his disciples had told him that Jesus was raising the dead, do you think that would dishearten him? I don't think so. I think John the Baptist has been given a bum rap here, because what he's asking is not what it appears. He's done this with his students, and he knows Jesus does it all the time with his disciples. Know the context of the verses that you're involved with, and you may get some extra information. We'll talk about the real question that John is asking in a minute. Calling two of his disciples, he sent them to the Lord to ask, "Are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else?" Now, on the face of it, it looks like he's doubting whether Jesus is the Messiah. But what evidence does John have that Jesus is the Messiah? He was told something. We talked about it before. He was told something early in his ministry to watch for something. The Spirit of God descending upon someone like a dove. He said, that's the Messiah. You'll know who it is. And John testified that Jesus was what? The Lamb of God, who does what? Takes away the sins of the world. So John was rock solid in his faith. I don't think he's asking the question that it appears that he's asking. So why would he ask in a roundabout way? Well, let's see what his question really is. When the men came to Jesus, they said, "John the Baptist sent us to ask you, are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else?" At that very time, Jesus cured many who had diseases, sicknesses, and evil spirits, and gave sight to many who were blind. So he replied to the messengers, "Go back and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me." So he's giving them proofs of who he is. Of course, these are things that were prophesied about the Messiah where? Where in the Old Testament? Isaiah had something to say about many, if not all, of these things. And other places as well record that the Messiah would do these things. Are you the one who was to come? Why didn't John the Baptist just simply say, "Are you the Messiah?" He's not really asking that question. Who is the one who was to come? Well, he's asking it about a very special verse in the Old Testament that says, "See, your king comes to you." And so it is, he's the one who is to come. Well, where is that verse? Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Does Jesus know that verse? Sure he does. How do you know? He did this, didn't he? He fulfilled this prophecy later on, sent his disciples as he approached Jerusalem for the last time, sent his disciples to get the colt, and they put him on it, and he rode into what's called into Jerusalem in what's called what? What is it? What's this event called? Triumphal entry into Jerusalem. He's coming to Jerusalem as king. Kings ride like this. All right. Your king comes to you. Okay, question. Of course. Oh, sure he did. He knew who Jesus was. And so he's asking Jesus to look at that verse and look at its context. The context of this verse contains John's question. Okay? Let's see what it is. If you go to the verse before, I will defend my house against marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for now I am keeping watch. That's what comes before, see, your king comes to you. And it's talking about the king. What does it say, really, in a very interesting way? Who's in charge? All that's going to happen to the king, he's in charge, isn't he? Everything's going to happen to Jesus, he knows what's going to happen to him as he goes into Jerusalem, and he's watching. And John knows that. All right, let's see what comes after. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim, the war horses from Jerusalem. The battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. The river, of course, is Euphrates. As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. What's John asking? Are you going to come get me out of jail? Now we'll see that Jesus understands it that way. Am I going to get out of jail? And he knows that Jesus has the power to release him. Suppose John had asked that question outright, sent his messengers to Jesus, are you going to get me out of jail? What would be Herod's? Herod find out about that. What would be Herod's response? Well, not just fortify the jail. he'd start chasing Jesus, probably, as an enemy. And suppose Jesus released John from jail, turned a prisoner loose illegally. What would the authorities in Jerusalem say about him? He's an enemy of the state. That gives them an excuse to crucify him, doesn't it? They couldn't find anything, remember? And so he has to be very careful not to give them any ammunition here in doing this. So this is a message under a message. You have to know the context to understand it. I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. Well, let's go back and look at Jesus' answer. I'm going to look at two of them. You can look the rest of them up in Isaiah. The blind receive sight. The good news is preached to the poor. Now, those are the very words that Jesus used, even though this is in Hebrew and the gospel is written in Greek. He's very careful to say it exactly that way. Okay, where do we find about the blind receive sight? Well, that's in Isaiah 42, about the servant of the Lord. It's clearly a story about the Messiah. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. Take hold of your hand. I'll keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people, a light for the Gentiles, to open the eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. That's what follows that verse, to open the eyes that are blind. But Jesus doesn't say that, does he? The other part, Spirit of the Lord is on me. This is the one that Jesus used in Nazareth when he read from Isaiah to the people and they rejected him, you remember, early on in his ministry. The Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release for the prisoners. That's what John's looking for. But notice, all of the things that are said in Jesus' answer, not one word about release of the prisoners from the dungeons. He could have said it, but he deliberately did not. So what is his answer to John? You're not going to get out of jail. I'm sorry, you'll not be released from prison. Don't lose heart on account of me. He added that at the end, didn't he? Why was that important? If you look at the ministry of Jesus and John, they overlap only a little bit, long enough for John to point out that Jesus is the Messiah. But if they both continued parallel, and even though John was killed in prison, his disciples continued for a long time. Years after that, there were still disciples of John the Baptist operating throughout the world, really. And so God really didn't want to have two competing groups like that. You see a little bit of conflict with them when John's disciples complain about Jesus' disciples still baptizing too. And John kept telling them, he must increase and I must decrease. Well, that was God's will, that John should die in prison. I want to give you one more example. At the death of Jesus. Yes. Jesus was, yeah. Can be damaged, it sure can. That's true. Don't let circumstances discourage you. Okay, Jesus on the cross. You're all familiar with this, I'm sure. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, and of course that was Aramaic, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then in John, if you put all four Gospels together, you can find seven things that Jesus said from the cross, seven sayings. You might have read that somewhere or gone through the list yourself, but you can make your own list. And the last thing apparently that he said is recorded by John. He said, it is finished. With that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit, which means what? He died. Okay? Those two sayings of Jesus are references to something in the Old Testament. They didn't have any way of saying Psalm 22. They weren't numbered. But my God, why have you forsaken me, is the first verse of a psalm, and that's how they identified psalms, by their verses. Psalm 22, verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? And Psalm 22, the last verses in the psalm, posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, for he has done it. The word in the Hebrew could be translated, he has finished it. It is finished. Two references to this particular psalm at the end of Jesus' stay on the cross. This psalm is a remarkable psalm. If you've ever read it very carefully, we've talked about it some in classes here, I know. The Hebrew rabbis call it the death psalm. It's about a man, and it was written 1,000 years before the Romans invented the torturous death of crucifixion. But it clearly describes someone going through that agony, if you read all of the details. The Jewish rabbis, today at least, recognize it and call it the death psalm, and it is their aspiration in life to recite that psalm on their deathbed as they are dying. I have no idea whether Jesus was trying to do that or not when he was dying. And in all likelihood, that's not the case. But still, it's remarkable that the modern rabbis recognize it that way, and they know what it represents, crucifixion. And of course, that will play a large factor in our discussion at the end of the course when we ask the question, why don't the Jewish rabbis believe that Jesus is the Messiah? We'll answer that question to some extent a little later. Okay, Dan? Well, David was a prophet, but prophets don't always know the things that they utter are prophecy. I don't know why David was inspired to write this in particular, but it obviously has that application ultimately in the New Testament, and Jesus, I think, is pointing out to everyone around him, go look at Psalm 22. It applies in this situation. It's his final fulfillment of prophecy, really. Except for resurrection from the dead and things that followed it, but it's one of, and as his life was ending. Yes, a point. Oh, yeah. That's right. A second king
as well. Yeah.
He's the one. That's an interesting point. Yeah. Yeah. That's a possibility, of course, but I think John knew better. Certainly in discussing this with his cousin over the time that they had together when they were both working together. Yes, apparently we talked about that early, didn't we? That he probably grew up in that community. And the Jews had a real problem with the fact that the Messiah was going to suffer and yet the Messiah was going to be a king like David. And they struggled with that. And one of the answers that they had was there's going to be two Messiahs, as he was pointing out. And maybe John is asking a question about that too. But nonetheless, Jesus doesn't leave any doubt about it in his answer. Well, the thing that we've talked about today I just hope that you get a feel for the importance of knowing the text, teaching the text, living the text, and maybe even dying the text. Good point. Yes. I would think so. Yeah. We don't know that he said anything about the intermediate parts, but he's pointing out, go read that psalm, it applies to me. I think that's essentially what he's saying. And it's a very powerful point, I think, that he's making. But that's how they referenced verses in the Hebrew Bible, was by the first verse of a psalm or the verse in a section or giving it a title like the account of the bush. And so we have it much easier because we have chapters and verses, but I think it's important for us to read it without that so that we get the coherence of it. But as you study something, we've made the mistake in the past of studying things in isolation a lot. And we need to look at the context, what comes before it, what comes after it, follow the flow of the story as it's presented to us. Okay, next week we're going to talk about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alton. That one was really a stretch for me.
Okay.
It's one of those things, it's like reading C.S. Lewis. It wasn't just what he said, but it was the springboard to thought.
Yeah.
That it represented. And it's just...
Well, it's deeper than we normally go. Yeah.